is absent of any concept of economic growth. The situation in Somalia is one of the poorest undeveloped countries in Africa. There are other countries like that. And what they have needed, the overall situation of the Horn of Africa, because of its strategic location in the Gulf of Aden along the Indian Ocean, because of the growth of Al-Shabaab and other extremist violent groups, that should be one of development. Ethiopia has 110 million people. Most of these people are poor. The majority of these people have no electricity. That's the same situation in Somalia. We should treat the region as a regional concern and promote a policy where we actually bring the people in Ethiopia and Somalia out of poverty. If you eliminate poverty and you eliminate hunger, you can bring stability to the region. And that's what our policy should be.
Mr. Freeman there says elimination of poverty will restore stability in the Horn of Africa region. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, and unfortunately, our time is up for today. On behalf of my colleagues here, I would like to thank you all. Have a great time and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The importance of combating corruption in the judiciary branch and protecting the reputation of honorable judges. You should not say, No, we know him. The report is not correct. You should not act like this. You must dispatch a vigilant investigation team. This is one of those conditions where you should take the reports seriously. I think it was in the previous term. I do not correctly remember if this happened at the time of Mr. Raisi or in the previous term when they put together a team which would secretly visit courts of law in provincial cities and would keep things under surveillance. This is a very good course of action. You should mobilize and dispatch individuals to verify the matter and to see how much this claim is true or not. After all, seeing with one's own eyes is very effective. On paper, many things cannot be understood. Unfortunately, these days I cannot have much contact with the people. But for many years, I always had a lot of contact with people. I witnessed things that are only understood in public meetings and in direct contacts. Things that cannot be understood on paper and by reading reports and the like.
Subhanallah.
The judiciary branch should be in close contact with people and with active groups in society. The next point is about presence among the people, a point that I just mentioned. One of Mr. Raisi's strong points in the judiciary branch was presence among the people. You should not stop doing this. The honorable officials in the judiciary branch should not stop doing this after his departure. This is a very good and important course of action, and as I mentioned earlier, it will yield many blessings. Being among the people and being in contact with active groups in society, such as academic, seminary, and economic activists, and activists working on matters related to women and the ones working on tribal matters, being in contact with them is very important. It is very important that judiciary officials, especially the head of the judiciary, be in contact with the groups that work in these fields. There is so much in the field of production that one cannot understand until one has contacted and heard from the people who are active in the issues of production, such as officials in charge of labor issues and laborers themselves. Communication with these active groups is part of popular presence and public communication, and therefore we must pay attention to it.
In the limelight.
One way of thinking about the U.S. military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by the U.S. state's algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Scott Temke, author. This article is published under the heading West Africa, its latest testing ground for U.S. military artificial intelligence. Stay tuned for more. One striking feature of U.S. military involvement in West Africa is the absence of an observable strategic vision for a desired end state. Nominally, U.S. presence in the region's multi-layered conflicts revolves around building security cooperation with state partners to improve counterterrorism capabilities, ostensibly providing protection to communities that states cannot. Concurrently, the U.S. military is typically the prime diplomatic entity for high-level bilateral engagements. The result is that the U.S. military is propping up the public authority of weak states, albeit in an ad hoc fashion that lurches from crisis to crisis. Regardless of the reasons for U.S. presence, there is hardly any deep public support for these operations. About 60% of U.S. citizens do not view these kinds of conflicts as a security threat, and more than 90% oppose U.S. invasions, even if weapons of mass destruction were in use. For the first time in recent memory, U.S. international relations scholar John Mearsheimer and Stephen Vogt write, large numbers of Americans are openly questioning their country's grand strategy. Even within the Department of Defense, these doubts continue to periodically arise. As former Defense Secretary Mark Esper testified in February 2020 to the House Armed Services Committee, conventional forces in Niger, Chad, and Mali need to go back to home so they can prepare for great power competition. Due to war fatigue, the U.S. has resorted to externalizing the strategic and operational burden of war to human and technological surrogates, creating what some scholars call a form of surrogate warfare. One example of externalizing the burden of the war to the machine is a tool created by Defense Innovation Unit and deployed at the Al Oid Air Base in Qatar in 2017. Throughout its deployments, this tool monitored and rapidly combined social media feeds in Syria before relaying that information to pilots and ground troops, who then used it to identify, track, and strike targets in that area of operations. General Joseph Votel, then commander of U.S. Central Command, boasted of the model's success and indicated that it would be replicated in future operations. In its preparation for great power competition, the U.S. military is modernizing its Joint Airborne Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance, that is ISR, capabilities by exploring the uses of artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques for target identification. The final goal is to connect ISR sensors across all war-fighting domains, including space, air, land, sea, and cyber, directly the commanders and weapon systems, sharing data at an accelerated speed. In Niger, this project has materialized as the deployment of the new Block 5 variant of MQ-9 Reaper, a drone first used in Syria in 2017. The Block's fifth major upgrades include the ability to integrate and combine multiple data feeds, as well as to process this data more quickly. Since 2018, the U.S. has similarly armed their drones in Niger. In this fashion, West Africa joins Syria as a place that has become a testbed for this new wave of ISR technologies. The ISR modernization program follows prior U.S. military investment in the region with projects like the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, a military aid package of $353 million. These military initiatives contribute to the African continent's status as a long-standing field site for experimentation that traverses the colonial and post-colonial eras. More recently, since the publication of the Burke Report, Africa has been a proving ground for the neoliberal thought that permeates development economics, advocating for structural adjustment policies while most foreign direct investment is concentrated in resource extraction economies. This thinking tended to stop well short of acknowledging the enduring damage done by colonialism on the continent. Niger's colonial experience was particularly vicious, with French military violence used to pacify the territory. This trend continued in the lead-up to Niger's 1960 independence, a as French military forces suppressed opposition so the French state could consolidate control over uranium deposits discovered between 1957 and 1967 and other minerals useful for high technology industries. Today, uranium from French mines accounts for about 70% of Niger's exports, but tax exemptions mean that little of that value flows to state or its citizens. It is against this background that Niger provides a good case study of intersection between the rural poor's land struggles and U.S. military presence. Most Nigerians are subsistence farmers whose land tenure rights are insecure. The country is susceptible to frequent drought and severe food shortages, conditions which have been exacerbated by climate change. As of 2004, 9% of Nigerians, about 870,000 people, were enslaved or lived as bonded laborers. One way of thinking about the U.S. military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by U.S. state algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Arguably, because of a strategic non-oversight, West Africa is conducive for testing these weapon systems and assessing how they form a kind of predatory formation that spans from the borders to the hinterlands of the world.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Spotlight.
Now, for the first time in decades, South Africa is calling up thousands of reservists to tackle a wave of looting and violence. Food, fuel, and medicine chains have been targeted. More than 110 people have been killed and thousands more arrested. Now, all this since former President Jacob Zuma started a 15-month jail term last week. Now, what has turned rallies into violent encounters and lootings in a matter of a week? And that's what we'll put on the spotlight.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after it defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What can come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight with me, Behrouz Najafi. Now, let's see who's joining us in this edition. Full professor of political science and deputy dean of research with the University of Western Cape, author of The Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from the 1920s to 1970s, Becky Ngomezulo in Cape Town. Okay, we'll also have the endowed of the History and African American Studies author of The White Supremacy, Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston. Now, Becky, a call-up on this scale has never happened since the end of the apartheid regime in 1994. What's been behind such an unprecedented mayhem and violence in South Africa?
Thank you very much, and good evening to our listeners. Basically, it's a combination of factors. Some of the issues have been there since 1994. When we got our freedom or our democracy in 1994, there were certain things that were not done, and there are a number of promises that were made, but which were never fulfilled. And these things have been piling up. All they needed was just a spark to ignite and then bring the country to where it is right now. So the reason why we have so many soldiers being dispatched to try and contain the situation is because of a number of mistakes that have happened, starting with the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, and then, of course, starting with the Zondo Commission on the allegations of state capture. So there have been a number of mistakes from all ends, and then when those mistakes were not corrected on time, the situation deteriorated and got out of hand. And government was unable to contain the situation using the police, as is usually the case. Hence then the reason to bring in the army to try and assist the police force. This is basically unprecedented in the post-apartheid era, and it's a shame to the country, to the continent.
Okay, Gerald, businesses in South Africa are mainly owned by whites, as you know, and they make up about 9% of the working population there. Now, most of the country's arable land remains are also owned by white farmers. The apartheid is gone, but South Africa still has one of the highest inequality rates. What's your take on that?
Well, I think if you look at what happened in neighboring Zimbabwe, when there was an attempt to redress economic inequality that's grounded in racism, you saw that seizing the land of the so-called white minority caused sanctions to be imposed upon the Zimbabwean regime, and to an extent, those sanctions are still there. That was the signal to the incoming African National Congress government in 1994 that it should tread carefully. Therefore, the finger of accusations should be pointed at the sanctions imposing government, speaking of London and Washington in the first place. And that brings me to the other issue. When the African National Congress government came to power in 1994, one of its major allies, speaking of the Soviet Union, had just collapsed. That helped to empower the major ally of the white minority, speaking of the United States of America, and that also handicapped the ability of the incoming ANC government to address these questions of equality and inequality. And I would add another factor. and that is the maladministration of Jacob Zuma now sitting in prison. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake when the African National Congress government recalled his predecessor, speaking of Thabo Mbeki, who was the successor as president of Nelson Mandela. They recalled Mbeki put Zuma in that position. There were many reasons for that, but in any case, in retrospect, that was a major blunder, because now Zuma and his comrades and cronies charged with looting the treasury of billions and billions of dollars that could have been used to redress inequality, could have been used to confront this COVID crisis that is now harming South Africa more than any other country on the African continent. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Mr. Zuma personally bears a good deal of responsibility for this crisis, as does the members of the African National Congress who helped to put him in office in the first place.
Okay. Now, Becky, as you know, the unemployment rate is pretty high in South Africa, especially among the youth. It's reached a record level of nearly 33% in the first quarter of 2021. So tell us how seriously this unemployment thing could affect the tide of dissatisfaction and all these objections.
Yes, indeed, it is a critical factor. And in fact, what started off as a group of people who were supporting the former President Zuma, as I said earlier on, it triggered the problems that were already underlying there, and we're just waiting for a trigger to spike all of these things that have happened. If you look at the population of South Africa and the population of the African continent for that matter, it is predominantly young. So then if you have a number of graduates who leave universities and colleges and then join the public with the hope of bettering their lives, and only to find themselves adding numbers to the unemployment rate, then of course it's a cause for concern.
Okay, looks like we've had some technical problem. Let's turn to Houston. Gerald, protests into the jailing of Zuma turned into looting and vandalism, as you know. Is this the disgruntled people? Who is leading this?
Well, that is a major question. The government has suggested that there are disgruntled elements within the ranks of the African National Congress, within the ranks of the security forces, who have played a very negative role with regard to the plundering and looting that has taken place in South Africa in recent days. That bespeaks, I'm afraid to say, the factionalism within the highest ranks of the African National Congress. But there is another issue, too, that should be addressed. Given that we are putting so much weight on the misrule, alleged misdeeds of the African National Congress, that raises the question of where's the opposition? And that, too, is a problem, because if you look at the major opposition party, which is the Democratic Alliance, so-called, it's basically a neo-apartheid policy. It basically seeks to defend the interests of the so-called white minority, and therefore does not have much purchase or much of a reputation amongst the African majority. Then you have a group like the so-called economic fighters, which tries to posture itself to the left of the African National Congress. But recall that when Mr. Zuma came into power more than a decade ago, one of the major backers of Mr. Zuma was Julius Malema, who then went on to lead the economic freedom fighters. In fact, he was quoted at the time as saying he would give his life on behalf of Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the political opposition has not carried the kind of responsibility that it should have, and that only contributes to the crisis.
Okay, Becky in Cape Town seems to be back. Becky, you hear me, right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, Becky, you know, this military deployment is huge and it's extremely costly and could impose further burden on South African faltering economy. And vigilante groups have been formed to protect infrastructure in their neighborhoods. So what's the right way to restore calm?
You know, there are a couple of issues. For me, one of the options is for the justice system to correct itself. Because if you look at the manner in which The case of former President Zuma was handled, as I said earlier on, it was not handled properly. The judiciary was supposed to have looked at the law, what the law says, but then at the same time consider the possible options in law and then look at the political situation in the country. One of the options they would have taken, for example, would be to say former President Zuma has been found to be in contempt of court, and then he's in the wrong, and therefore you find him guilty. But then in terms of sanctioning, they should have just said they are giving him a suspended sentence, not because he has not done anything wrong, but because they are trying to remedy the situation. The second option was, in fact, in my view, okay, a mistake. And on Monday, by the way, there were presentations by former President Zuma's team trying to plead with the Constitutional Court to reverse its decision, and the judgment has been withheld until further notice. So right now, there is no political solution to this issue, because legally, the president cannot give him pardon unless he has served at least a quarter of his sentence. So the onus now is on the judiciary to rescue the situation without contravening the constitution and also without breaking the law, because in any case, they will be found to have been in contempt of the law themselves. So for me, that is where I see things going right now.
Okay, now let me turn to Houston and ask Gerald what he thinks is the right way to handle this. Because, you know, Gerald, this has been really unprecedented since a long time ago, like we spoke about. You know, there's vandalism, there is looting and killing. So is this army deployment the right thing to do? Could that restore tranquility or what?
I'm not sure if putting more soldiers on the streets will restore tranquility. Recall that just a few days ago, the president, Mr. Ramaphosa, suggested that there would only be 2,500 soldiers. Mm-hmm. Now there are about 10 times that many, and the unrest continues in KwaZulu-Natal. I think that part of the problem in South Africa, and it's a question that has occurred to me and many friends here in the United States, is that it's rather curious that Mr. Zuma, a post-1994 president, has been jailed, and yet these pre-1994 leaders, of which there are many in South Africa, that is to say those who devised apartheid, those who presided over terror and murder, none of them have been jailed. So I would hope that coming out of this crisis is a decision to go after some of the folks who helped to create this crisis in the first place, speaking of these allies of the United States of America, speaking of these enforcers of apartheid, because we all recognize that one of the reasons why there's so much poverty and inequality in South Africa in the first instance that has driven people into the streets is that it's the direct legacy of apartheid. If that is the case, and it certainly is the case, will those who helped to devise apartheid and enforce apartheid have blood on their hands, and they should be punished accordingly?
Okay. Now, Becky, there are some analysts who attribute the situation to factional rivalries inside the ruling African National Congress Party, and that was what Gerald also referred to. Is that the case in your opinion?
No, it is absolutely one of the contributing factors, but not the only factor. Because right now, if you look at the governing party, you look at the NWC, the National Working Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the National Executive Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the PEC, the Provincial Executive Committees, in all the 9 provinces, they are divided to the core. And then it goes down to the local branches. So if you have that kind of a situation, it means that whatever action you take will be interpreted along those lines. And in fact, I may add that when the president addressed the nation both on Sunday and on Monday, he didn't help the situation, because he gave the impression that this can be reduced to nothing but ethnic mobilization. That is the concept he used, ethnic mobilization. And I'm one of the people who have subsequently written pieces challenging him on that, saying that if you reduce this important issue to ethnic mobilization, the next thing that will happen, you will have racial problems like we're seeing already right now. So I think there are a couple of problems that need to be attended to, but factionalism in the ANC in fact creates fertile ground for all these other problems to crop up.
Okay. Now, Gerald, there are also some people that are saying that there is evidence that followers of former President Zuma have provoked some of the recent unrest to undermine rivals to return him to power. Is that a possibility?
Well, certainly if you look at the social media feeds of some of Mr. Zuma's family members, not to mention some of his comrades and friends, it would obviously lead you to that conclusion. But I think we need to take a step back and look at the region as a whole. That is to say, it was only a few days ago that neighboring Swaziland, Eswatini as it's now called, was going up in flames. So people were being killed by the security forces because of protests against the last absolute monarchy on the African continent. Zimbabwe, the neighbor to the north, as mentioned, is still reeling from sanctions imposed by the United States, Great Britain, and its allies because of its land reform program. And that has led to a steady drift, a steady migration of people from Zimbabwe into South Africa, which then puts pressure on the social welfare system in South Africa, puts pressure on the system of employment in South Africa as well, contributing to these problems. And then to the east and to the north, you see problems in Mozambique, which is suffering from an insurgency spearheaded by religious zealots who supposedly have ties to the so-called Islamic State. And in fact, there has been talk about South Africa and its neighbors contributing troops to Mozambique, and that too has led to a migration of Mozambicans into South Africa. So you cannot look at South Africa in a vacuum. You have to look at it in the regional context, and when you do, you see that there are many regional problems that are impinging upon the rule of the African National Congress in Pretoria.
Okay. Now, Becky, business confidence has plunged further, especially with this recent looting taking place in South Africa. On top of that, there is unemployment that you mentioned, especially among the youth, complicating the situation. So what's the solution?
At the moment, there is no immediate solution. The first thing that we can do, I was saying to you, some people in the media houses earlier today, that the first step for me is to eliminate one problem which sparked this whole thing. That is the issue of the former president. Try to address it within the parameters of the law. Like I was saying, that the judges have withheld the judgment on the appeal that has been made. So that is for me the first step. Because once you eliminate that one, then it means that those who have joined the bandwagon, either as opportunists or as criminals, we will then be in a position to face them because you will have eliminated the main causal factor. So that is the first step. Then, of course, the other one will be for the government to try as much as possible to make sense of the situation and then bring together the international community, more especially international businesses and local businesses, and explain to them, give them confidence as to how they are handling the situation. Because the longer this turmoil takes, the more difficult it will be for the country to recover economically, given the fact that even before the pandemic, the country's economy was already not doing well. With or without the former president, the economy was just going down.
Now, Gerald, what's your prediction? What's going to happen next in the coming days? Will we see calm or will we see an escalation? We have 1 minute.
It's difficult to make a prediction, but I have to say I'm quite worried about the trend that's taking place in South Africa. You might have seen the statement put out by former President Thabo Mbeki, where he basically made the allegation that the entire post-1994 democratic process may be in jeopardy because of what's going on. Certainly the ongoing unrest in KwaZulu-Natal does not inspire confidence. However, I think that it's important for the South African authorities to redouble their efforts to redistribute the wealth, and particularly to redistribute the wealth on racial grounds, because that's the only way to address the toxic and poisonous legacy of apartheid.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had full professor of political science and deputy dean of research with the University of Western Cape, author of Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from 1920s to 1970s, Becky M. Gomezulo in Cape Town, an endowed chair of history and African American studies, author of White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston with their contribution. I've been your host, Pedro Sanchez, and I'll see you next time.
It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Joe Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. We now present you an article written by David P. Goldman, president of Macro Strategy LLC and senior writer at Law and Liberty. The piece is titled U.S. Fiscal Profligacy and the Impending Crisis. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Massive demand-side stimulus combined with the constraints on the supply side in the form of higher taxes is a sure recipe for inflation and eventual recession. According to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, the fiscal year 2021 U.S. budget deficit will amount to 15% of America's GDP, or gross domestic product, after the passage of an additional $1.9 trillion in demand stimulus, a proportion that the United States has not seen since the Second World War. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. The additional $2.3 trillion in so-called infrastructure spending that the Biden administration has proposed consists mainly of handouts to Democratic constituencies. During the 12 months ending in March, the deficit stood at 19% of gross domestic product, or GDP. Even worse, the Federal Reserve absorbed virtually all the increase in outstanding debt on its balance sheet. In the aftermath of the 2009 recession, when the deficit briefly rose to 10% of the gross domestic product GDP, foreigners bought about half of the total new issuance of Treasury debt. During the past 12 months, foreigners have been net sellers of U.S. government debt. The U.S. dollar's role as the world's principal reserve currency is eroding fast, and fiscal irresponsibility of this order threatens to accelerate the dollar's decline. The U.S. Federal Reserve has kept short-term interest rates low by monetizing debt, but long-term Treasury yields have risen by more than a percentage point since last July. Markets know that what can't go on forever won't. At some point, private holders of U.S. Treasury debt will liquidate their holdings, as foreigners have begun to do, and rates will rise sharply. For every percentage point increase in the cost of financing federal debt, The U.S. Treasury will have to pay an additional $250 billion in interest. The United States well may find itself in the position of Italy in 2018, but without the rich members of the European Union to bail it out. The flood of federal spending has had a number of dangerous effects already. The U.S. trade deficit in goods as of February 2021 reached an annualized rate of more than $1 trillion a year, an all-time record. China's exports to the United States over the past 12 months, ending in February, also reached an all-time record. Federal stimulus created demand that the U.S. productive facilities could not meet and produced a massive import boom. According to Philadelphia Federal Reserve survey, input prices to U.S. manufacturers in February rose at the fastest rate since 1973. And the gap between input prices and finished goods prices rose at the fastest rate since 2009. The Producer Price Index, PPI, for final demand rose at an annualized 11% rate during the first quarter of this year. The Consumer Price Index, CPI, shows year-on-year growth of only 1.7%, but that reflects dodgy measurements. For example, the price shelter, which comprises a third of the index, supposedly rose just 1.5% over the year, although home prices rose by as much as 10%. If foreigners are net sellers of U.S. Treasury securities, how is the United States financing an external deficit in the range of $1 trillion a year? The United States has two deficits to finance, the internal budget deficit and the balance of payment deficit, and here we refer to this second deficit. The answer is, according to the Treasury data, by selling stocks to foreigners. According to the Treasury International Capital, or TIC system, foreign investors have been dumping low-yielding U.S. treasuries and corporate bonds during the past year. Foreign investors bought $400 billion of U.S. equities and nearly $500 billion of U.S. agency securities backed by home mortgages during the 12 months through to January, but sold $600 billion of treasuries and $100 billion of corporate bonds. This is a bubble on top of a bubble. The U.S. Federal Reserve buys $4 trillion of Treasury securities and pushes the after-inflation yield below zero. That pushes investors into stocks. Foreigners don't want U.S. Treasuries at negative real yields, but they buy into the stock market, which keeps rising, because the U.S. Federal Reserve is pushing down bond yields and so forth. Today, however, the U.S. Treasury market is the weak link in the financial system, supported only by the central bank's monetization of debt. If the extreme fiscal profligacy of the Biden administration prompts private investors to exit the Treasury market, there will be no safe assets left in dollar financial markets. The knock-on effects would be extremely hard to control. The overwhelming majority of the over-the-counter privately traded derivatives contracts serve as interest rate hedges. Market participants typically pledge Treasury securities as collateral for those contracts. According to the Bank for International Settlements, the notional value of such contracts now exceeds $600 trillion. Derivative contracts entail a certain amount of market risk, and banks will enter into them with customers who want to hedge interest rate positions only if the customers put up collateral, like the cash margin on a stock bought on credit. The market value, after netting for matching contracts that cancel each other out, is about $15 trillion. If the prices of Treasury securities fall sharply, the result will be a global margin call in the derivatives market, forcing the liquidation of vast amounts of positions. Something like this occurred between 6th of March and 18th of March 2020, when the yield on inflation-protected U.S. Treasury securities, or TIPS, jumped from about negative 0.6% to positive 0.6% in just 2 weeks. The COVID-19 crash prompted a run on cash at American banks, as U.S. corporate borrowers drew down their credit lines. U.S. banks, in turn, cut credit lines to European and Japanese banks, who were forced to withdraw funding to their customers for currency hedges on holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. The customers, in turn, liquidated U.S. Treasury securities, and the Treasury market crashed. That was the first time that a Treasury market crash coincided with a stock market crash. Instead of acting as a crisis refuge, the U.S. Treasury market became the epicenter of the crisis itself. The U.S. Federal Reserve quickly stabilized the market through massive purchases of Treasury securities and through the extension of dollar swap lines to European central banks, which in turn restored dollar liquidity to their customers. The emergency actions were justified by the extraordinary circumstances of March of 2020. An external shock, namely the COVID-19 pandemic, upended financial markets, and the central bank acted responsibly in extending liquidity to the market. But the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Biden administration now propose to extend these emergency measures into a continuing flood of demand. The consequences will be dire. The present situation is unprecedented in another way as well. Not in the past century has the United States faced a competitor with an economy as big as ours, growing much faster than ours, in fact, with ambitions to displace us as the world's leading economic power. China believes that America's fiscal irresponsibility will undermine the dollar status as the world's reserve currency.